Hi, everyone, and welcome to this week's EHS podcast for the week ending February 20th. My name is Alan Nguyen, and I'll be bringing you the latest news in environmental health and safety. So our first story deals with a recent development in the transportation industry concerning the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration. So the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration, often referred to as the FMCSA, announced the formation of a new 26-member committee which offers guidance on training requirements for truck and bus drivers. In December, the FMCSA reported that it intended to establish a committee to examine minimum training requirements, including length of classroom instructions, accreditation versus certification of commercial driver's license training programs in schools, curricula for passenger, property, and hazardous materials carriers, and instructor qualifications, among other areas. The Entry-Level Driver Training Advisory Committee comprises of training organizations, the bus and trucking industries, law enforcement, labor unions, and safety advocates. The committee will feed its recommendations to the FMCSA prior to the agency's publication of a proposed training rule, which is expected this fall, and with the final rule expected to become effective in 2016. The committee will be led by Associate FMCSA Administrator for Policy Larry Miner, and the first public meeting of the committee will be held on February 26th and 27th in Arlington, Virginia. Transportation Secretary Anthony Fox was quoted as saying that for over the next 30 years, they would be relying on trucks and truckers to move more than 40% more freight than they currently do. Mr. Fox also added that with more people in freight crossing in the U.S. more than ever before, the committee's work will be critical to ensuring that commercial drivers are fully capable of operating their vehicles safely. The Entry-Level Driving Training Advisory Committee is made up of a cross-section of motor carrier interests, including training organizations, the inner-city bus and trucking industries, law enforcement, labor unions, and safety advocates. Among the 25 other committee members are Clyde Hart, acting FMCSA administrator during the Clinton administration and now an executive with the American Bus Association, union representation from the AFL-CIO and the Teamsters, Boyd Stevenson, a policy director for American Trucking Associations, David Heller, a policy director for the Truckload Carriers Association, two people representing owner-operators, and Louis Spoonhauer, a manager for refrigerated carrier Stevens Transport. The FMCSA is proceeding the rule to comply with MAP 21, the federal highway funding law passed in 2012. And as always, we provided a resource link to this story in this podcast if you're interested in learning more. And our next story addresses the recent changes to Canada's WMIS program. So Canada's National Hazards Communication Standard is changing to incorporate the globally harmonized system of classification and labeling of chemicals, also known as GHS, an internationally recognized standard for hazard classification and communication. On February 11, 2015, the Government of Canada published the Hazards Products Regulations. The new WMIS, now called WMIS 2015, is based on new requirements contained in the HPR and HPA as amended in 2014. The original WMIS, which remained virtually unchanged since 1988, is not being replaced but rather updated to align as closely as possible with the United States Hazard Communication Standard. The Government of Canada expects WMIS 2015 to help strengthen worker health and safety, facilitate trade with the U.S., and enhance the competitiveness of Canadian suppliers of workplace chemicals. While WMIS 2015 includes a new harmonized criteria for hazard classification and requirements for labels and safety data sheets, the roles and responsibilities of suppliers, employers, and workers have not changed. Health Canada and the federal, provincial, and territorial occupational health and safety agencies will also retain the same roles and responsibilities established with WMIS 1988. Health Canada has worked in partnership with the Canadian Centre for Occupational Health and Safety to develop and release helpful resource links about WMIS 2015. And if you're looking to find more information about the changes, be sure to check out the resource links of this podcast. And sticking with the theme of workplace health and safety, our next story deals with the implications of long-term shift work and its impact on mental health. So a recent study conducted by the Occupational and Environmental Medicine has found that long work hours can result in impairment of brain function. Various studies have proven that shift workers face a higher risk of being injured on the job than those who work days, and that such work can impact employees' health in various ways. But what about its impact on their brain function? Well, a recent study published in the Journal of Occupational and Environmental Medicine last November looked at the impact of shift work on workers' cognitive abilities. and found that shift work significantly impacted cognitive performance of workers who did such work for 10 years or more. A study was based on data taken from the VSAT study, which was designated to study the relationship between aging, health, and shift work. The initial sample composed of 3,000 present and former workers of both genders and ages 32 to 62 years in 1996. Researchers followed up with the subjects in 2001 and 2006. Workers' cognitive functioning was assessed at all three stages on preceding speed, selective attention, and verbal episodic memory. When examining the effect of shift work duration on cognitive performance, the study found that the effect was significant for workers who experienced shift work for more than 10 years, with cognitive less equivalent to 6.5 years of age-related decline. The good news is that the impact could be reversed by returning to normal day work hours. For example, workers who quit shift work for more than 5 years exhibited higher cognitive performances, at the same level as those who were always day workers. To reduce the impact of shift work on workers' physical and psychological health, the study has these recommendations for employers. So for starters, employers can move people from shift work after 10 years of exposure. They can also plan shifts as far in advance as possible. They can also keep schedules flexible by letting workers trade shifts. Another option is to schedule time off over weekends. Employers can also provide workshops and information sessions on stress management, make sure demands on workers are reasonable, maximize worker autonomy, include a mental health component to employee assistant programs. They can also consider offering facilities for social activities such as recreation and staff social gatherings. And finally, they can also provide regular health checks for shift workers and transfer them to day work if required. So as an employer, these are some of the ways you can help your employees alleviate these risks. And that concludes our podcast for this week. If you'd like to learn more about any of the stories that we covered, make sure you check out the resource links that we've provided. And as always, thanks for listening.